A couple of weeks ago, in my literature and religion class, we were discussing the 17th century English poet, John Donne. And one of his most famous sonnets that really bothered some of my students begins in part, "Batter my heart, three-personed God, for I am betrothed unto your enemy. Bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. Untie or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I never shall be free nor ever chaste, except you ravish me." One of my students emailed me after class and wondered if anyone would really wish for this kind of an assault from God that the poem describes. She put it forcefully. She says, the poem says, "Beat us up, God, to make us better. What kind of God is that?" And on the surface, it does seem to say that, but I tried to convince her in the class that John Donne's strong images of the spiritual life are not quite off the mark, really. For the heart of Christian spirituality is this irresistible grace of God that literally hounds us until we let go of our egos, that sneaks up on us and surprises us, that challenges us to grapple with God's presence, grapple with how faith challenges us, and grapple with greatness measured by our service to others. And I guess this came to mind because the prophet Isaiah says in our first reading that the Lord's suffering servant will be bruised, beaten, and bear the iniquities of the many. This surely describes Jesus, who came into the world, suffered, and died for us. And in our gospel, Jesus replies to that ancient question that all people ask in group dynamics. Who's going to be first? What's the pecking order? Where do I fit in? How do I get to the top? And Jesus replies that whoever is most truly the servant of others and thus suffers with and for them shall be the first among equals. He proclaims that he himself came not to rule, but to serve. Jesus calls us to see that a service to others that does not run away from suffering is part of being a full human person. You know, of the major world religions, only Christianity has this explicit, supernatural use for suffering. Only the Christian says that one can be bound to God intimately when we suffer. All the other great religious traditions, they wrestle with suffering. Some will deny it, or some will explain it away. Some will even try to escape from it. But Jesus tells us tonight that suffering is never far from one's experience of God. Just as Jesus gives his life over to God out of love and of trust, our life somehow is bound up to giving over our life, giving over our trust to one another, and ultimately to God. Now, before we go any further, we must remember that when we talk about serving one another and the virtue of suffering, we need to make clear what we're not talking about. We're not talking about suffering for its own sake, as if there's some sadomasochistic mystery that we're all participating in. We're not saying that the poor in Africa should suffer from hunger or AIDS, or that oppressed or marginalized peoples around the world should accept abuse or exploitation by the powerful. Now, that kind of suffering is an evil, and we name it as such. So what kind of suffering servant is Jesus alluding to? He says that if you want to know how deep God cares for you, if you want to know the depths of love and not just skim the surface, then you must accept such a thing as legitimate suffering, a suffering that comes with learning how to love yourself and learning how to love another person, of learning to be of service to another person's life. For what does Jesus do on the cross but risk his life for you? He certainly risks his life for the Father. He risks his life for his friends. He even risks his life for those two bickering brothers in the gospel, James and John. To suffer because we risk making our world a better place, to suffer through sacrificing our ego in order to live somewhere deep in our hearts, to suffer because we give up our wants and desires in order to come into contact with another person's wants and desires, this is a suffering that is holy and legitimate. It is the loss of a settled, comfortable, well-positioned life for the sake of a bigger and better vision of our world and our place in it. And yet, even now I find this hard to accept at times. For when things have gotten tough for me in the past, whether it was doubts about my own vocation, the anger at the continual sins of my church, the divisiveness of our politics, or just my own fatigue at trying to make my life work at Georgetown, I immediately look for the easy way out of the struggle. Anything from that non-committal response of whatever to a sort of kind of, we'll just bomb the hell out of them kind of mentality. But more profoundly, when I have suffered physically or emotionally, I find myself either praying it will go away or rationalizing it away, which we Jesuits do very, very well, or even worse, I get angry and I spiritually pout. Why me, God? Why us? Why can't I sit at your right hand? Why do I have to feed the hungry? Why do I care for the homeless? Why must I be attentive to the marginalized here at Trinity or on campus? Why must it be so hard? I sometimes wish I could just buy into the world's dream of power or see suffering as mere illusion and escape from it, but this is just so contrary to our faith in Jesus. For to accept his discipleship is to accept reality as it is and to stand with those who find themselves in the mess and the difficulties of it. To let go of my own vision of myself as competent, the professorial priest, to a vision of myself as a servant priest, a man of compassion. After all, the word compassion means literally to suffer with another, to suffer for another. So I think that's what we forget. The good news of Jesus is that God makes use of your suffering. In Christ, God absorbs our pain and suffering into his own flesh and transforms it into an act of love. And this is our call, to transform our suffering into an act of love. God redeems suffering by making it part of the greatest love story ever told, one repeated every day at this altar. We are all here today because we are somewhere on a journey towards discipleship, of losing ourselves in order to paradoxically find it again, fuller, deeper, and wiser. Jesus invites us to be vulnerable for love's sake, for God's sake, to risk loving a man, a woman, a partner, a friend, to risk giving one's life to one's family, to one's vocation, to risk giving one's life over to Jesus' vision of who is first and who is last. And it's risky because it competes with modernity's vision of human perfection, which insists that comfort and beauty and intelligence and wealth and power, they measure who's first and who is last, who has won and who has lost, who sits next to power and who suffers under power. And yet this is the paradoxical adventure that we're invited to, of saving our lives by losing it for love's sake. In this transaction, God exchanges our deformed and anxious and pouting and bruised sense of self for God's sense of ourself, God's sense of who we are. This is what James and John in our gospel really couldn't understand. They wanted Jesus to give them the power without the glory. They dreamt of power instead of dreaming of the power to help others. And Jesus immediately sees through this fallacy, this ultimate illusion, to make us think that real love does not, by its very nature, create such a vulnerability. My struggle to be a more loving man, your struggle to be a more loving person, it's a holy struggle. And if the struggle wears on us each week, then we come back to be nourished by the ultimate act of love, sharing this Eucharist together. In order to aspire to greatness, we must serve one another, because it's the only way to know the love of Jesus as our very own. God chooses this place, Trinity Church, to enter fully into life with us. Let us come to the altar and leave this church tonight, not looking to be served, but asking ourselves, how can I be more loving? And how can I be more kind?